Rich and I dive into the Sixers' Game 7 loss to the Atlanta Hawks, talk about where the series went off track, the mistakes made by Doc Rivers, the hiding act by Ben Simmons, and what all of that means for the short and long-term future of the team. All right, welcome everybody. This is Derek Bodner, joined by Rich Hoffman on the Sixers Beat, a part of the Athletics Podcast Network. Your 49-win Philadelphia 76ers, your top seed in the Eastern Conference, their season is over, as everyone listening to this has already figured out. I'm not breaking any news. Lost in 7 to the Atlanta Hawks. How you doing, Rich?
I'm fine. I understand a lot of our listeners probably are not. That was one of the
worst losses ever. Yeah.
I'm really struggling to put it into context, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of NBA, in terms of Philadelphia, it's way up there in any way you slice it.
I mean, look, we went in saying if Joel Embiid was healthy, they should win that in 5, maybe 6 if Trae Young gets hot. Joel Embiid, he wasn't healthy, obviously, but he played like he was healthy for the most part. Trae Young didn't have a great individual scoring series. He obviously did a lot for his teammates. If you say you got a very good version of Joel Embiid and a good but struggling at times version of Trae Young, like I think their defense had some success, and you walk away losing 3 games on your home floor, including a game 7, that is a massive, massive disappointment and a massive underachievement. And Doc Rivers tried to spin it that it wasn't. It is. We'll get into that in a bit later. It was a massive underachievement, and it's disappointing. It's frustrating. It's the kind of thing that could change the direction of a franchise on a dime. I guess let's take a step back, and I'm going to strike one off. You can't mention the past, but if you have one lasting memory of that series, what is it for you?
Oh, come on. You're setting me up for an easy one. The pass.
You can't do the pass. Pass doesn't count. It's too obvious.
My brain's broken. I didn't hear your qualifier there. Okay. Besides that, I think in terms of one single play, I mean,
it doesn't have to be one play. It could be just one. For me, it's one repeated play, and I think that probably gives it away.
One repeated play. Kevin Huerter taking Seth Curry.
It is Kevin Huerter destroying Seth Curry over and over. And this isn't like revisionist. Like I remember sitting there next to you going like throwing our hands up. Like what in the hell is going on? You have to send some help. This you can't. That outcome is not going to change. He's just, yeah.
I think I looked at you. I tapped you on the shoulder and I was like, Seth is meat right now.
Yeah, he had no chance. And everybody in the building knew it and they didn't give him enough help. And at the farther back I get, that becomes outside of the pass because that's very clearly obvious.
It's the capital pass. T, capital P. Like that's there will be no other pass besides the pass.
But yeah, having Seth just get roasted over and over and over again, and that really does show the two things that really I think frustrate a lot of people in this series. You've got Ben Simmons and the pass, and I took him off the table. That doesn't count. And you've got the coaching, which wasn't up to task, which I wasn't expecting coming in. And those, to me, are the two major takeaways.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair to Doc, and by the way, he is going to get a lot of heat because I haven't loved his comments afterwards either. You also had a roster that there's too many one-way players on this team. And Seth Curry is an absolutely fantastic addition. His shooting for this entire year probably helped Embiid get to those levels even when he was struggling in the middle of the year post-COVID. And he had one of the best shooting series I've ever seen. But yeah, I mean, that was really bad. And Doc did not find a way to give him any help with a lot of defensive talent on the team besides that. So yeah, I mean, I'm with you. Just an out-and-out catastrophe. There is a reason that nobody around the team, I think they all just kind of logged off Twitter for the last few days, which smart move. Really bad. I mean, it took away. It's unbelievable how they really had a very good regular season And in the matter of a week, all of that goodwill is gone because they were that bad in the most critical moment.
And they had a solid first round of playoffs. Like that thing, I think, went mostly according to script. And that second round did not. I mean, look, if you look it up, so Sixers had a 112.5 offensive rating. And I'm going off the top of my head here, so it might be slightly off. In the regular season, which was like 13th. They had less than that in the second round. They had like a 111 in the second round against the Atlanta Hawks team, which was at very best mediocre. I think they were like 19th or 20th in defense over the season. And they had, it's not like, I don't think Atlanta really did anything that was super tough to exploit. Like the Sixers just didn't execute. Joel Embiid in the second half of the series didn't execute. Tobias Harris in the second half of the series was not good enough. Ben Simmons just completely turtled. And I don't think they really did enough to get any of those three going offensively. And it was to have, look, I expected their half-court offense to be a problem. I really did. And we spent most of the season being like, yeah, they're in first place in the East. I'm not sure if this half-court offense is sustainable in the playoffs against good defenses. They should have been able to walk all over that Atlanta team. And they did for the first three games of the series. Like it was going according to script outside of the first half of game one. And then everything just changed. And I still don't know if I have a complete grasp on how they just stopped executing to that degree.
The offense falling off a cliff is the, you know, while there are a lot of things going on about Doc and Ben, and they are a huge part of this, that's the team story, is that the offense through the first three games of this series and the first eight games of their playoffs was cooking. Yep. They were playing great. Tobias was playing great. Obviously, Joe was playing great. In the last four games of this series, a 102.8 offensive rating.
Honestly, that I hadn't looked that up. That is stunning. That is stunningly bad against a defense. Again, go back to our pre-series discussion, and maybe we were wrong on some of it. I don't really think that we were. That was a team you should have been able to cook. Like, that was a team that shouldn't have been able to take away from the Sixers' strengths, and they just did. And that 102, 10 whatever, that's fucking abysmal for this day and age. That is abysmal. It's not like you're going up against the Raptors here. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it is abysmal. The Raptors, the season they won the championship, were, you know, I think Ben Taylor and a bunch of other people looked at their defense throughout the entire playoffs. They were an all-time great NBA playoff defense, and they had the players to prove it. You know, this team doesn't have that.
No.
It's crazy. It's
Kevin Huerter and John Collins and Trey Young. Like, you should have been able to.
I mean, like, look, we'll get into Ben. I'll just say this: Ben let Danilo Gallinari guard him the entire series. Danilo Gallinari was. It wasn't even a hiding spot. It was a point of strength to put him on Ben Simmons because he could just stand in the lane. And Gallo, who is an awful, awful defensive player, Ben had nothing for. I'm not attacking Gallo. I have no answer for. And that's just, I mean, that's the whole series. And you know, I got to say, too, like in the last couple of games, specifically game seven, you're watching these horrible Tobias Harris isolations.
Yeah.
Just absolutely horrible. And they're not running any offense. It's stagnant. It's bad. And just after every game, you hear Doc saying, "We didn't run our stuff. That's your fault.
Right.
That's
Do
your
something.
Fault, my
Do
man.
Something.
That is, look, I get it. The NBA, the playoffs, they do turn into an isolation fest. That's why we always say you need that great perimeter offensive player. At some point, you just can't run plays to make up for that. This was not that point. You should be able to execute against this team with what the Sixers had and what the Hawks had, which were a ton of terrible defensive players.
Terrible.
It was a calamity on a million fronts. And, it's one that, it's funny. I was thinking about this today. I'm sure that the venom will soften with time for all of these individuals in this team. It always will. And by the way, there's no way it couldn't go down after the last day because they got absolutely roasted by everybody from Philadelphia to national media. And hey, by the way, the other thing I don't want to hear, it's like the people that are saying, well, Philadelphia, they're going to run this team out of town. Like Philadelphia is not handling this well. This was an all-time collapse by players on this team, Ben Simmons, and this team. There is no fan base or city or anything that would handle this well. Get out of here.
Sorry, no, the, off track there. The only fan base that handles this well is a disinterested fan base. And that's not what you want. Any fan base that was actually invested in this team, that watched them win 49 games in a 72-game season and lead the Eastern Conference, have the MVP runner-up, have the Defensive Player of the Year runner-up, they would have had sky-high expectations, and they would have held them accountable for coming up small. And that's, like, they really, really came up small. Yeah, you should be frustrated. You should be able to voice that frustration respectfully, of course. But yeah, that was bad. It's bad.
You know what I was thinking too? This is a team that, and I don't necessarily mean this as an insult at all times. This is a very good front running team, yeah, usually. Not this series, because they blew a gigantic lead. But they finally face a little bit of adversity this season. It's not crazy adversity. It's like, oh, the Hawks are playing pretty well. It's still the Atlanta Hawks, and they can't get over the hump. And I agree and with what Daryl...
That's from your best players, too. Like, that's from Joel, yeah, going ISO hero ball, and Tobias going ISO hero ball, and Ben going turtle. And that's from your best players. It's from the players who got you there.
I mean, honestly, the guy who had the best moment against adversity this entire season was Tyrese Maxey, yeah, in Game 6. And like we said in the previous pod, he might just be too young to know what he got himself into.
Yeah, and he's not developed enough to have that every night. Like, he didn't have a good Game 7.
No, which is fine. We're very consistent on Tyrese Maxey. He had a nice season. So I agree with Daryl Morey, though, in that the way the Sixers played this series, even if they had won Game 7, I think they would have gotten their ass kicked in the next round.
Oh, yeah. I texted Spike, and like, people don't want to hear it, but it's what I felt like. Even if they win, they're losing in 5. I have no confidence in the squad right now.
Yeah, and that's disappointing. And look, you want that opportunity. I don't think losing Game 7 was necessarily a good thing, but it was even more revealing, I got to say.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a team that wasn't even close to a title contender.
No, and they could have turned it around. Like, maybe Joel starts feeling better with some time off, if they could have closed out the Hawks quickly, which at one point when they were up 2-1 and had a huge Game 4 lead, it looks like they might have been able to close out the series quickly. Maybe they get some rest. Maybe Ben Simmons regains his confidence and they have a chance against the Bucks. But like, the way they were playing, no, they had no chance. No chance.
So yeah, I think to wrap it all up, just kind of the general thoughts, it was bad, guys. It was really bad.
If you're a fan, that's to me is the most frustrating series during this era, by far.
I think during any era. I mean, it's not like the Sixers have played a lot of high profile basketball pre-process, but
yeah, it's been I'd have to really dig into the banks to go previous.
If you told me it was their highest profile defeat collapse, or like most frustrating, yeah, one since the '80s,
yeah,
yeah, since the '80s, yeah, I would absolutely believe that.
How many times was Barkley even a favorite in a series? Like, that team wasn't, I don't know.
Would they make the second round a couple times? Yeah,
yeah, but they always lost to, like, the Knicks or the Bulls.
What are we saying? If you're like 40 years old, this is absolutely the worst loss you've ever seen.
In part because you never get to the playoffs in your lifetime. Yeah, all right. So I guess, do we want to go to Doc's comments or Doc's decisions first?
Let's do decisions first.
I mean, game one coming out with Green was, I cost him the game. Not helping Seth enough was, we already talked about that, very frustrating and predictable. The bench, holy shit. And like, look, I get like he was probably going to run a 7-man rotation for all of it. I do think a 10-man rotation in game 7 is a bit much. But like the Dwight stuff, I mean, look, go back midway through the season. We're talking like February. On this podcast, we said, I'm worried that Dwight Howard is going to be this year's Montrez. I think Dwight Howard was this year's Montrez. He had no chance defending in that series. If he has no chance defending in... You already start off... Okay, so Dwight and Matisse make bench lineups offensively pretty much a disaster. You can't put... Even when Ben's playing well, you can't put Ben with them. You know, going in, they're not going to score points. And whether you go with the Tobias and bench units, the all bench units, the Ben and bench units, none of them throughout the season have scored points. If Dwight, I'm like completely lost here. If Dwight can't defend, like he usually can. And I think in this matchup, he couldn't. And it was very clear early on. It was very clear going in. You have a massive problem. And I give Daryl a bit of blame here. I mean, we talked about the backup center and not having a stretch five all season. So I give him some blame. Maybe there wasn't a move out there to help. I do think, theoretically, the Tony Bradley for George Hill should have helped more than it did. And I guess we can get into George Hill in a bit, too.
And like you said, the idea of getting the stretch five backup center would be to let Ben loose. And I'm not sure that was even going to happen.
No, I'm not sure that was even going to happen anyway. But even defensively, I would make an argument that Ben Simmons at the five with four wing players would have held up better defensively against the Hawks. Because, again, they weren't going against, like, Dwight Howard was not matched up with Clint Capella much. Rebounding wasn't a huge problem. What the Hawks don't have a lot of, they don't attack the rim. They don't put pressure on the rim. You don't really need shot blocking the way you normally do. What you need are some big, active, mobile, like-size defenders who can defend Atlanta's bevy of spot-up shooting tall forwards. I think Ben at the five would have helped. Not only would it have helped unlock Ben a little more, not only would it have been a little bit easier to put another ball handler on alongside Ben, but I think it would have competed defensively. Maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. Like, Ben at the five hasn't been great, but I think this is the matchup where Dwight at the five wasn't going to work. I think this was a matchup where Ben at the five had the best chance of working, and the fact they didn't try. They just didn't try. They just kept running out the same lineup that didn't freaking work all series long. It was very frustrating to me.
So the numbers on that, the third most used lineup, if you go to NBA stats for the playoffs, this is 34 minutes. The Sixers had it is a George Hill, Shake Milton, Matisse Thybulle, Tobias Harris, Dwight Howard lineup. Played 34 minutes together. They had a minus 15.6 net rating, and the big problem there is a 94.3 offensive rating with that group, which is just awful. Yeah, and I mean, this is the concern with Doc. You know, we talked about this the entire year. Where
talked about this before the year with Tim Cato. Not Tim Cato. Johan. Yeah. Got Tim on the mind because he just wrote a big story. We talked about this before the year. Like, he has his regular season system. It works. He can be a little slow to adjust off of that. And I certainly think we saw that here in this series.
They just didn't have any answers outside of what they did in the regular season. His only adjustment was, okay, bench guard X is not playing well.
Right, let's try throw in the other bench guard Y. Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, shifting the makeup of the team, getting more versatile, just trying stuff, he didn't do anything. And that's bad. But it's also a product of, you know, he had this one thing that I think worked for the most part in the regular season, and he just kept sticking to it. And I completely agree with you. I mean, those Dwight minutes,
it was a little Budenholzer-esque. Not this year, previous years, where you have a system, it works, you don't experiment enough, and the playoff comes and you're not prepared for it.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
And I mean, those Dwight minutes, I think he was only like minus five in game seven, only minus five. But that's a good snapshot, the way I described that, of how bad those minutes were. You were just hanging on for dear life, hoping to not get destroyed in those minutes. And that's no way to go about a playoff series. It's just I mean, it was really bad. And I think Daryl deserves a decent amount of blame for that too. Like he did not give Doc a ton of other good options outside of that. But I have, you know, look, after watching that series, I have very little faith in Doc Rivers, by the way, who an offense minded coach to not be able to, you know, you're having Seth Curry shoot really well for the most part. And Embiid did slow down in the fourth quarters of these games. And I think that's not all on Doc. Like, you need your best player. And Simmons was a massive problem. I mean, I think that's something that needs to be considered too when you're talking about Doc. That said, Doc didn't solve anything. And and it's another tough playoff loss for him. And then, like you said, the comments he made after the game, didn't like it.
No, and like the most egregious was, to me, bringing up the previous year. I don't have the exact quote in front of me. I'll find it while you're talking. But he said, he said, listen, this is a team that got swept in the first round last year. I'm not going to make this a negative, which is completely disingenuous. Like, that team had gone to the second round 2 out of 3 seasons before that. Or the 2 previous seasons before that. They didn't get to the second round in large part because Ben Simmons wasn't available. This is a team right now that has Seth Curry and Danny Green and Ben Simmons that were not available to that team last year. It's been overhauled pretty substantially. The goal wasn't to get to the second round of the playoffs, Doc. The goal was to get beyond the second round of the playoffs, which your predecessor couldn't do, and to get the 1 seed and lose to the Hawks. And look, I'm not
killing the sentiment. Like, he could have been like, look, we did some good things this year, right, but we ultimately fell short. But to just be like, I came in and saved this thing. Right. You know, it's just
completely disingenuous and dog shit, and just not what the fan base wants to hear. It's not it's not true.
It's not true. And also, look, this was a crazy regular season where teams were being wiped out due to COVID for half a year. And that's not to say, look, the Sixers, they faced their own share of adversity, especially with Embiid getting hurt in the middle of the year. But I mean, the idea of, I don't know, it just felt like he was very proud of his coaching job this season, where,
like, how dare you question me? This team got out of couldn't win a game in the playoffs last year.
But he said the entire year too, like, look, it's nice that we got the number 1 seed, but we're playing for a lot more than that.
That is a means to an end.
I just thought his perspective was so bad.
He went into, like, he needs to save his ass mode right away. It was...
Yeah. Didn't like it.
No.
I haven't seen that from a coach here. And that's... look, he's got a big resume. He's a big personality as far as coaches are concerned. He's got a lot of, I guess, clout in the league. That's what a lot of people said. But this is, I don't know, the response to some adversity here, both on the court and off the court, I wasn't crazy. Doc Rivers did not cover himself in glory the past week and a half.
Dwight Howard, a negative 12.5 net rating in 69 minutes. They got outscored by 23 points in 69 minutes. It's not great.
No.
Especially when, like, what if you add up all the Sixers' 4 losses, how many did they lose by total? What we got?
3.
I'm going to do some math on the fly right here. Yeah. 4, 3, 3, and 7. So that's what, 17 points over 4 games? Little shit matters.
It's the good thing is that nobody is blaming Dwight, which is...
No, it's not his...
I'm happy for it. It's not his fault.
Not his fault.
He probably could have played in a series late in the playoffs if there was like a backup big guy. Like, if they played the Clippers in the finals and Boogie Cousins was playing against him, I think he realistically could have played against him. But he's a situational player. Look, he was available for the veterans minimum for a reason. You know, he's a situational player who I think for the most part had a very positive effect on the Sixers this year. But to not have a backup plan to the backup center is just, you need that in the modern NBA. And
he was a situational player who they treated as a solution all season. And in the regular season, he mostly was, but it was predictable that he wouldn't be in the playoffs. It would be like, if I said, hey, Rich, my sink isn't working. Come over here and fix it or you're fired. Like, that's not your job. That's not your skill. I mean, maybe it is. Maybe you're a handyman. I don't know. But it would be completely unfair to put your job on the line for that. I don't blame Dwight.
I'm a minus 60.
Yeah, fixing. I'm not a handyman.
Fixing sinks, man. I'm pretty bad.
Some electronic shit I can get by with, but not house shit. Which brings me into some off-season to-do list. But anyway, a very, very frustrating series from Doc. And quite frankly, like, they failed in ways I didn't expect them to. I didn't expect to be having... there were some adjustments I was concerned about, specifically Dwight. We spent all year worried about the Dwight adjustment. The offensive struggles, I did not see coming. I did not see coming at all.
They came out of nowhere, and you would think maybe after a game, maybe two, he would put his foot down and say, all right, let's get back on track. And it just never happened. And that, to a large degree, that's his responsibility.
And yeah, it's not like we're going to blame a lot on Ben, who's next topic of this podcast.
And Ben deserves the most blame. He deserves more than Doc.
For sure. But that was not the entirety of the Sixers' offensive struggles. Went way, way beyond that. And it did go in part to Joel. He was not nearly as good outside of that first half of game five when he came out on fire?
Yeah.
Yeah, first half of game five. Outside of that, he was not nearly as good in 4, 5, 6, or 7. I don't know how much of that was knee. I don't know how much of that was frustration. I don't know how much of that was bad decision-making. He had 21 turnovers in the last three games, which is hashtag not great.
Yeah.
But the offensive failure goes everywhere. It goes everywhere with this team.
I mean, Tobias missing a ton of bunnies in game 7.
Oh, my God. That he had so many good looks. It was, yeah, that was, and that's probably the one that I blame the least. Not necessarily Tobias, because I think some of his decision making in games 5 and 6 were not great. But the layups that he couldn't make, transition half court didn't matter. If he got to the rim, he was missing it, which was not ideal.
You did point it out. He just has some stretches where every layup can't make is a layup. Complete adventure.
He turns into Robert Covington at the worst times. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I love Cove, but like a layup, I'd rather have Cove shooting a contested three than a layup.
Yeah, and I'd rather have Tobias make his layups instead of miss them. Yeah, it's, I don't know. Those were a lot of great shots in game 7, and I think a lot of the problems we can talk about are more process errors, like the just predictable things that went wrong. I don't know. I thought Tobias's process was okay. It just didn't make the shots, which is still very frustrating.
Certainly in game 7. Certainly in game 7. All right. Let's go to the turtle-sized elephant in the room. You go ahead. I don't... I feel like this is the only topic we're going to talk about for the next 4 weeks, so start it off on however you want.
No, I'm going to ask you something quickly. Do you think this is the most damaging series for an individual player in recent NBA history?
That's a great question. Certainly in terms of a player's psyche, yeah. But in terms of like league-wide perception and trade value, throwing out injuries, like career debilitating injuries.
Yeah.
I would struggle to find one that's more damaging, yeah.
So the only one I could think of, when I think of like a damaging individual series, and this is on a completely different level, the one that always comes to mind to me is the one where LeBron choked against Dallas. In the finals.
Sure.
But he was still LeBron.
Skip Bayless had a field day with that one, yeah.
Yeah, and he couldn't, you know, there was the joke, he couldn't post up J.J. Barea and all of those things. But he was still the greatest player in the world at that time. But, you know, I guess at that point, there was a lot of noise surrounding, is this guy ever going to be able to, you know, break through? It sounds silly now. He's got 4 titles. He's made the finals pretty much every year since then. But, That's the only other one I can think of. In terms of just like an all-star player, though, I guess Paul George had some rough series the last couple of years. He had a rough game last night with the free throws, but I don't know. This feels different than most things, and it was rare. Like, I think you saw just general media on Monday. Ben Simmons got crushed in a way you just don't normally see. And I'm not saying it wasn't deserved. It just...
He's an interesting player because for years he's had people who do not like his game and do not like his personality and have been very strongly on one side. And then you have the other side who has defended him and likes his defense and likes his passing and likes what he brings. And I think even the people who have defended him have now struggled to defend him over the last week. The people who previously didn't like him are having a field day. So it has become very, very, very one-sided. And I do think that will tilt a little bit back here a month from now, but I don't know if it's tilting all the way back. I don't know if he's getting all of his supporters back, and he's certainly the people who didn't like him before are not switching sides. Do I think there's a chance Ben Simmons is traded this summer? Yes, of course. Do I think it's a foregone conclusion, though? Truthfully don't know. Because I don't, and I wrote this, we wrote a, we recapped Daryl Morey's press conference on an article last night. And I wrote this, and it's like, first of all, I don't think Daryl is going to trade it. Like, I don't think Daryl gives one shit about fan sentiment right now. He's going to do what he thinks is best for the team. And with Ben's trade value so tanked, and look, GMs watch the playoffs. Like, there would be no way to watch Ben Simmons the past week or two and say, I know what we're going to get from him in the playoffs. You can't do it. His trade value is definitely lower than it was 2 months ago. Certainly lower than it was 2 years ago. And I think in order for Daryl to trade him, I don't think he's going to come into the offseason. Daryl spent a lot of time in his press conference yesterday talking about you can't come into something with a goal or a priority or we have to do this in mind. And he wasn't talking about Ben Simmons when he said that. He was talking about, do you need more perimeter shot creation, I think was specifically the context. But I think it implies to Ben Simmons too, I don't think he's going to come into this offseason and say, I have to trade Ben. Because if you do that, you're going to get fleeced. And you're going to get fleeced bad. And the Sixers just don't have enough assets to be able to take 20 cents on the dollar for Ben Simmons and still put enough talent around Joel Embiid to win a title. Does that mean Simmons is going to be on the team long term? I don't know that either. But there is a world where Daryl Morey doesn't get the trade that he wants, and Ben Simmons could suit up for game one, for sure.
He is their last big card they have to play. And we would have said this before he melted down in this series. I mean, the last big trade that they can make, now maybe they could package some picks together and mortgage their future or something like that. But in terms of what they have on the roster or other people's picks or whatever, they have one big card left to play before you're looking at Embiid.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I think, you know, give it some time. It's not going away, the stink of this series, but it'll certainly, the volume will lower a little bit. Just natural that it does. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I felt like I talked over you a lot there.
I agree with you. I think when you look at what his trade value is now, I frankly, at this point, I understand that he still has a lot of talent, but how can anybody who has any aspiration of playing playoff basketball view that as even a positive value contract at this point? He can help you get to the playoffs, but once you see what he has done, and this is not just this season. This season is the cherry on top of the shit sandwich of the Ben Simmons playoff experience. But, it's been bad for years in the same predictable ways. So, I don't know. If you are another GM, you know, I think that the thing I keep hearing is, like, they have TV, too. Yeah. They were watching the games, you know. TNT, I'm pretty sure it's in every market that GMs have. So, yeah, it's a it's an interesting thing, though, man. Like, I understand the point. I know after the game, emotions are high, but I do understand the reaction of, like, he can't play another game in Philadelphia again. Sure. Because this was that bad. But I also understand that Morey should not be caving to those emotions and whatever if the right deal does not pop up.
And look, it is completely fair to think, well, Daryl's asking price had to have gone down after that series, in part because what he was asking for before will probably never be on the table again, barring Ben coming back and having a good playoff run. And really, that's what it's going to take. Like, Ben could come out and do whatever he wants in a regular season. I don't think his trade value is going to be really rehabilitated by next year's trade deadline, because I think it's going to take having to do that in the playoffs for anyone to really buy into it, and against good playoff competition, not just the first round. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, Daryl's demands have to have dropped. His willingness to have to move him, you would assume, has gone up. That doesn't mean he's going to get something he thinks actually moves them closer to a championship winner. And it's not great. Like, I wrote in a column the night the season ended, and it was really about how the organization over the last 5 to 6 years has failed Embiid. But in that, I wrote that they're less flexible than they've ever been. And I had some people through DMs, like, sort of push back on that. And look, that, and I think Daryl might have sort of referenced it when he said there were 25, 26 teams who would love to be in the position that the Sixers are in, which I don't think is contradictory, because when you have an MVP candidate, there are a lot of teams that would trade places with you. But my whole thing was that Joel Embiid, the way he's developed and improved, deserves a championship caliber supporting cast, and the Sixers haven't given that to him. And I think now they are less flexible to put that supporting cast around him than they ever have been. And I got some pushback on that, in part because of Maxey's development, in part because they don't have the negative contracts of Horford around anymore.
That's a lot of pressure on Maxey.
That is a lot of pressure on Maxey. And look, does Maxey help? Yeah, he helps not only because he gives you something you've never had in terms of shot creation, but he also helps because he could be a trade chip, which nobody wants to hear, but he's worth far more than he was when he was the 21st pick in the draft.
That's true.
That being said, when you start talking about having the chips to build a championship caliber team around Joel Embiid, the tanking of Ben Simmons' trade value to me outweighs that by an order of magnitude. So, okay, now let's say you've come to the conclusion that Ben Simmons isn't good enough to be the second best player on a championship team alongside Joel Embiid. And I think that alongside Joel Embiid is certainly important. We spent an entire series watching Joel Embiid double and triple team because Ben Simmons' defender was in his lap right from the jump. If you've come to that conclusion, now is the worst time to trade Ben Simmons. And Daryl is going to have his work cut out for him. It's not going to be easy to navigate. There might be a world where the Sixers, in order to be the best team, don't trade Ben Simmons, which would be, if that gives you anxiety, I sort of get it. I would love for Ben to go put in the work and really figure this out and come back next year a different player and come back a confident player. Why would I have any confidence that's going to happen?
Yeah. And with Doc saying that he is confident, and look, I'm actually not going to kill him about this.
It's his first year. He should feel like, you know, most coaches step in. And that's part of the reason why maybe you do end up finding a taker for Ben that will give you value, because a lot of coaches have a sort of irrational confidence that they have the right buttons to push. They have the right way to get him to realize his full potential.
Well, yeah, and whatever you think about Ben, he still has talent. There's a finite 100% amount of talent in the NBA. 100%. So, you know, there are these teams that, and it's tough to acquire that talent. That's why teams tank, and that's why, you know, teams plan around opening cap space to try and make a splash for these major free agents. For, you know, they make that like a 4-year plan. So, you know, with talent being tough to come by, there is definitely a world in which the right team for Daryl Morey this offseason that has the right return package talks himself into Ben Simmons and thinks, you know, they can get the most out of him. So I don't think that that's a crazy idea. And I think you got it right. Like, is there a world in which Ben Simmons is traded this offseason? Yeah, absolutely. I think the Sixers will look to do it if they can find the right trade. They'll probably push harder than they did even before. But it has to be the right one. So going back to Doc's comments, though, the idea that he is the person that's going to fix Ben Simmons. He's like, I've been here for a year. I know what the right move is. That's a tough sell. I'm not killing Doc on that, because this is more of a Ben problem than him. But the idea that Doc is the person after... Look, I mean, the Sixers, they've had NBA coaches for years try and fix this. They've had competent people for years, like, understand what Ben's issues are in the half court, and they just haven't done anything. They haven't gotten through to him. And Doc, the other part of it, too, is Doc, again, like, he really tried to pump Ben up this year and pretend nothing was wrong with him, and it didn't work. At all.
Do you remember that one press conference where he's like, you guys can focus on what he doesn't do. I'll focus on what he does.
And that's a larger portion of the Ben Simmons discourse of the talk about what he's good at, where I think this series is probably the end of that. I think even the biggest Ben Simmons defenders can say, we're not going to just keep screaming at you that he's good at this stuff, because it's clear his inability to score in the half court against a set defense for a myriad of reasons is a major problem when it actually matters. And so I look at this Ben thing in a couple of ways when it comes to what we just witnessed, which was just excruciating. It was painful to watch. The pass, that is a broken person in terms of how he's processing the court. He's just not even looking at the rim. I think on some level you can feel bad for Ben. You can have some empathy, because 100%. It is clear that for whatever reason, and Doc, I was surprised he mentioned the family stuff, and he was so open about how that could have been a part of it, which, like, look, that I can't even imagine going through that if I was Ben. You add in that, you add in the fact that he couldn't make his free throws. I think you can feel a decent amount of empathy for this guy. He just went through, you know, an out-of-body experience almost. It was just he was not – it was like he was not present on the court. He did not want to be there. That is one part of it, and that is fair. The other part, in which I think if you're a teammate or as coaches, and especially if you're a teammate like Joel Embiid, who has been there for Ben Simmons' entire career, where you can have almost no sympathy for him, is that he has had this same problem for 4 years. The Boston Celtics in 2018 gave him the playbook on, hey, like in the playoffs, you're not going to be as good playing this one style. And the quote, I said this last time, but the one that always sticks out to me is, you need to move outside your comfort zone, which is what Embiid said passive aggressively, and he never did it.
Yep.
Now maybe, you know, and I think he kind of skated by the last two playoffs, because one of them, they had Jimmy Butler, so people were kind of less concerned about the fact that he was rather uninvolved offensively. And the other one, he was hurt for. And that is the weird thing about Ben Simmons, is that you can say, in that Boston Celtics series in the bubble, A, the Sixers missed him, and B, he was lucky he didn't play in that series, because he would have been really bad offensively.
Yeah.
And I think both of those statements are true. But at this point, like, look, it's funny that, like, he did the fit. It felt like he wouldn't shoot or he wouldn't go to the line to avoid going out of that comfort zone, to avoid these small humiliations. And what he got at the end of it was the greatest humiliation of all, and that is that he surrendered in a playoff series against a team that wasn't even that good. And I'm sorry, like, I think for the most part, when you look at what his last 3 years are like, if I was his teammate or I was his coach, that would be absolutely maddening to me.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of the reason why what we talked about before a season was, hey, the number one thing I care about with Ben Simmons this year is his free throw attempts, because that goes back to his confidence and whether or not he's going to attack. What happened, look, there is a normal limitations Ben Simmons imposes on you, which is the complete lack of shooting and the fact that he won't attack at times. And those have real impacts on the Sixers' half-court offense all the time. And then there's whatever happened to him here in the last 3 weeks, where once he started getting intentionally fouled, really by Scott Brooks in that first series, it completely changed his confidence, and that completely changed his game. It ratcheted up his lack of aggression to the nth degree. And do I still think that the free throw thing should be able to be fixed? Yes. And how differently would this series have gone if he could have shot 60% from the line instead of 30 or whatever he shot? It's impossible to know. He might have come out and been the at least normal regular season Ben that can still be frustrating, but you can at least win with. And there's part of me that says, all right, well, look, let's say he becomes a 60, 65% free throw shooter consistently, has actually a little bit of confidence in that. Markel would have worked out. Like, is there a world where Embiid and Simmons could work together? I'm still not completely given up on that dream. But after watching what we watched and the way that the confidence really got to him, I have no confidence that it's going to be realized, and no confidence that they're going to have the chips to get Ben into the role he needs to be while putting the rest of the talent around Joel. And you are getting the point. Look, Joel is 27. It's not super old, but you just don't have all that many ways to get a championship caliber core around him. You have to investigate everything at this point. Everything.
Well, and Doc said before the year that he set the goal for Ben to shoot 10 free throws per game. He shot 4.9 free throws per game, which is less than the previous 2 years. It's about the same if you look at it on a per-minute basis. He played a few less minutes per game. This guy, if you can shoot, you need to be the most confident rim attacker in the world. You need to be going downhill at all times. And he is so unbelievably far away from that, to the point where he was scared to play a playoff series. I don't know. It's tough. I got to say, though, like, as much as we talk, like, the idea of, hey, they just need him attacking and getting to the rim. I agree. That would be a better version of Ben Simmons if they can get him going to the rim. Man, if he can't shoot, he's useless off the ball. And that's a huge problem.
You know, that's why when everyone's like, oh, we'll just make him the power forward. Okay. What does that fucking solve?
I think that is the most overblown thing in the world. Yeah.
Look,
would he
be better if there was a real elite shot creator next to him? Yes.
No, I think the team would be better. I don't think he would
be better. No, he wouldn't be. That's fair. That's fair. The team would be better. That's what I meant.
There's a difference. So it's like, well, if you bring in a real point guard, like if you could get, like, you know, a Damian Lillard level point guard, yeah, no shit, the team would be better if they had that.
Yeah.
But it would make him better. Frankly, he would be even less active off the ball. And if you had a player like that, I think, like, his stats would take a hit. Kind of the cheap assists that he gets would take a hit. The idea that you could just move him to another position and that'll make him a better player somehow, I think that's a little bit, I think that's overblown. The idea of he could be a power forward on a championship team. Yeah, but that has to do with the quality of the player you're bringing in. It doesn't have to do with how he's used, because there's no way to use him if he can't shoot at all off the ball. There's no way. Centers shoot in the NBA now. The hardest thing to guard in the NBA is five out. So if you have a power forward who can't shoot off the ball, again, I'm just saying, like, that can't be brushed over. Like, this was the fact that he just struggled so much mentally in this series, that's bad. Even if his mental, as he would say, is in the right place and he gets that, you know, gets that better and he starts shooting more free throws, he could be the most confident guy in the world. You're still going to run into a wall at some point in the next two rounds.
Yep.
It's hard. Here is where I also feel a little bit bad for him. If he got drafted by another team where he was the star of the team, I'm not saying he would be considered like the greatest player in the world, but if he played for Indiana or something like that, a team that really their only goal was to make the playoffs, maybe they win a series once in a while. Yep. And he can play this, you know, this style. And by the way, notice that I'm not saying give him five shooters, you have a championship. Because that's gone too.
You have a playoff team. If he's just
playing in a less pressure-filled environment, the conversation around him is difficult. Unfortunately, he plays with Joel Embiid, who you have no business not being at least in the championship conversation with Joel Embiid playing like this right now. And so the expectation is, how much can you help us win a championship? And unfortunately, he absolutely killed them. I mean, he if you want to say he single-handedly lost them a series, that's not true, but he might as well have.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's I still think he's a top 30 player in the league. But he does look a lot more like a floor raiser right now than a ceiling raiser. Especially when you talk about Joel Embiid and what he needs as a teammate, as a team constructed around him. And I think the way you said that, if he was in Indy and they were trying to make the playoffs and be exciting, be a good defensive team, I think he has a lot to fill in that role. But you're trying to build a champion around Joel Embiid, and not being able to shoot, not being willing to shoot, not being able to take a free throw, not being able to handle the ball late in games was all very debilitating. And going back to your point, like, I feel for him too. Like, this is, look, I have, these are complex human beings that we treat as objects on a basketball court. Like, they're 2K players. They're not. They're complex human beings. And I have some aspects of my life that I am supremely confident in, probably to the point of borderline cocky. I have other aspects where if you saw that and was on public display, you'd wonder how I'm a functioning human being. We all have our strengths and weaknesses. He just happens to be confident or lack confidence, like a debilitating lack of confidence in A, one area that's crucial for his job, and B, one area that is on extreme public display. I do think Ben has put in work here over the last couple of years. I do wonder whether or not he has been open and receptive to the wide scale changes that he needs to get to that point. And I think there's some hesitance and some friction there, but I don't think he's completely oblivious to the fact that he can't shoot and that that has an impact. He might push back at times that, hey, my strengths are being glossed over, but I think he understands that he has this weakness. I mean, look, that player on the court was keenly aware that he couldn't shoot a free throw. That's part of the problem. I do feel some level of sympathy for him, but you do also then have to be like, okay, well, how do we realistically approach this? How do we solve this? How do we deal with this? And it's tough. It's tough.
I think the only step forward for him, the only optimistic view you can say is when you hit rock bottom like this, failure has to be the greatest motivating factor
Didn't
ever.
Didn't we say that in 2018 though? In 2019?
Look, I agree, but this is different.
It is different.
That was, Ben Simmons not quite as good in the playoffs. Let's talk about Brett Brown. 2019, Ben Simmons wasn't that involved, but Jimmy Butler was great, and Kawhi, what a shot. You know, it's like one of those things. Last year, it was, they missed Ben Simmons in the playoffs. They kind of missed him. So honestly, it felt like he kind of skated by this issue to a degree that he probably shouldn't have, but just because the way the playoffs kind of worked the last few years. Yeah, you would think. Like, honestly, I agree with you. I thought 2018 should be all of the motivating factor he needed to get better to this point. But, dude, this is rock bottom. I mean, this is way worse than that. This was public. This was to a worse team. I mean, it's tough.
we got the draft in. What, 4 weeks? 5 weeks? A little over 4 weeks.
Not ready
to talk about the draft yet.
No. And one other thought on Ben. I mean, it's just this team, they can't have anything normal happen to them.
No, they can't. They can't.
Markel forgot how to shoot.
George Hill came here. He didn't want to shoot. Not that George he was Hill ever was so bad. A big shooter, but like he averaged like 2 points per game in a playoff or in a second round and shot 30%.
Markel didn't know how to shoot. Okafor wasn't good. I mean, we could just go back, you know, Colangelo with his burners.
Noel shit all over his apartment.
All these things. And then you have a guy in Ben who, look, for a number one overall pick is not a bust. He's had a nice career so far. He's made all-star teams, all of these things. But even he has this fatal flaw that has this super embarrassing moment that really is kind of unprecedented in the NBA. And I don't know. It's just, until this is...
How do you end up with...
I don't know.
They have a post-up center, and they have a monopoly on point guards who can't shoot. It's amazing. It's amazing. And Markel could... Oh, I don't need to get into Markel. Oh, that's a depressing one. You got anything else? I'm not even sure what else I got. I've entered a tailspin.
Yeah, my bad. Once I said Markel, I think I'm not sure we'd be able to...
Yesterday was the anniversary, a four-year anniversary of drafting him.
Yeah. Well, too bad. I guess, I'm sorry to all of our listeners. That was a tough podcast. That was a tough series. Maybe, the good news is summer. Hopefully you could take some vacation. Maybe... go to the beach or something like that. Take your mind off it. I mean, if at least the good news is I'm not sure the playoffs are going to make you feel better, but at least it's not like the Celtics or the Heat or somebody who are going to win the championship at this point.
No, you're going to watch Giannis go to the finals now.
Yeah, I think in terms of like how painful the team that wins the title, I feel like, Giannis against the Suns or somebody, that'd be a pretty good story. Monty Williams, by the way, he said that his cool play last night he stole from Brett Brown. Big time. Coaches. That's all I got, though. Yeah.
Let's end it on this. Going into the offseason, who is the best player that you are confident, 100% confident, will be on the Sixers next year besides Joel Embiid?
Best player on them? Oh, Tobias Harris.
It is Tobias because of the contract, though. It's not good enough, Rich. You need more.
Look, but...
That is like the biggest depressing thing about this here is you thought at least you had a big two to build around and you had how many years did we say, okay, well, how do you finish off this big three? It was Markel. It was LeBron. It was Paul George trading for Kawhi, all of this shit. Now you're sitting here and you're going, well, how do we get a big two again?
Zaire. No, I'm kidding.
He said he was going to be Kawhi. Do you remember when he said that at the end of season? Exit interviews.
I do remember that.
I think he was serious too.
Well, that was the whole theory of this team, though, right? Because Daryl got these guys that like Seth and Danny who fit for the most part. Like the fit was better, the shooting was better. But the unspoken part of that was okay. We're gonna get these role players who are not, you know, you're not gonna confuse them for superstars by any means. Like they're limited players. The part that was unspoken about that is, all right, we can maybe win pretty big with these guys, but our best two players have to be awesome. Yeah. And you had one best player who was awesome and another one who was far short of that.
Yeah. Yep. And look, Daryl is, I think Daryl is very focused on star player acquisition. I think he's going to be very aggressive here over the next year or two to try to get Joel what he needs to win a championship while he's still in his prime. I just thought you had more to work with, and I'm a little concerned.
He was still feeling it yesterday, by the way, when he did his press conference. Usually, you know, like usually I associate him with being in a pretty good mood. Like maybe it's not always going to be the I'm just riffing baby press conference, but man, he was at the end of it. He was like, yeah, it's still pretty raw. This sucks. So I think that is a good snapshot of, how do people in the organization feel too?
It is. I got nothing else.
I got no more. I was a little bit rambling, a little bit sad, but you know what? That's what this series was. So,
well, thank you, Rich, for jumping on. We'll hopefully have some more uplifting podcasts here in the future, but talk to you soon.
See you, man.